This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Important policy decisions are in progress about where to reduce troop levels in Iraq, when, and by how much. Just yesterday, word that 12,000 American troops will leave by September as part of President Obama's larger plan to get all U.S. troops out by the end of 2011. The basis for these decisions is partly objective, levels of violence, numbers of Iraqi troops, partly subjective, assessments of Iraq's political, military, and economic progress, and partly it's based on U.S. politics. We have any number of sophisticated methods to measure that last category. We still get it wrong from time to time. But as for the others, how do we know what we think we know about Iraq? Today, how we gather information on Iraq through the fog of war. Later, John Ridley joins us on the opinion page to talk about the not-so-simple process of transferring the panels of a comic book onto the movie screen with the case in point of the new hit film Watchmen. But first, Iraq, if you've been there, do the statements of policymakers and the news reports you hear and see reflect the story as you know it? Tell us your story. Our phone number, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. That's at npr.org. Just click on Talk of the Nation. As military correspondent for The Washington Post, Tom Ricks covered Iraq from the start. He's now the special military correspondent for the paper. Just published his second book on the war called The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq. He's with us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you back on the program, Tom.
Thank you.
How hard is it to find out what's really going on in Iraq?
It's always been hard. I think it's a little bit easier now than it used to be. For me, I covered the U.S. military. I'm not an Iraq expert. I don't speak Arabic. I left that side of the equation to our reporters who did, like Anthony Shadid, who can knock around, who looks Iraqi, and has a feel for the country. For me, it was a matter of being around the U.S. military. And the odd thing for me was after I wrote the book Fiasco, which came out in 2006, it became much easier. It opened a lot of doors for me.
Really?
Well, partly because the war in 07, at the beginning of the surge, was turned over to the dissidents inside the U.S. military and the national security establishment. Ambassador Crocker, for example, reveals in the book that he had opposed the invasion of Iraq. General Petraeus, when he took command in Iraq, had just finished supervising the counterinsurgency manual, which can be read as a scathing critique of how the military carried out the occupation for several years.
Well, after writing a book called Fiasco, were you worried that you were going to get shut out?
I wasn't really, partly because I knew the reaction from day one was very warm. Every day for months, I got emails from guys who had served in Iraq saying, thank you for finally telling it, you know, for getting the story right. Thank you for understanding what we're going through out here. But when I was writing this book, I'd go out to Baghdad and I'd be doing interviews. And at the end of the interview, I would frequently, a guy would take a copy of Fiasco off the bookshelf or out of a rucksack and say, would you autograph my copy for me?
That's fascinating. But if you're trying to get at the reality of Iraq, which clearly you're trying to do, can you do that only talking to American soldiers?
No. You can get to the reality of the U.S. military in Iraq, which is my area of expertise. I decided in The Gamble to not even try to do a quick one-over on what Iraqis were doing and thinking. There's other people who can do it much better than I can. What I tried to capture was simply what the U.S. military was doing and thinking.
Yet you've reached some sobering assessments, as we mentioned earlier, about the administration's hopes to be out by 2011. You say, well, nobody in Iraq thinks that, but how can you make that assessment without talking to the Iraqis?
Well, the closer you get to Baghdad, the more you find the U.S. military also says that. We are stuck there. I personally think that leaving Iraq is immoral. I think that staying is immoral. I don't think there are any good moral solutions. What we're stuck in is a position of asking what's the least bad solution.
We want to hear from those of you who've been in Iraq and how your story matches up with what the accounts that you've read and heard since, and what policymakers have to say as well. Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Chris is on the line from Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Yeah, hello. I was in Iraq in 2005, and I was based with a military police unit in Baghdad. And I think the one thing that I'll always remember is every time we came under fire while we were down there, it was inevitable that we would get called off, our military police unit would, because we were trying to let the Iraqi police take care of things. And, I mean, most of the things that I heard the military policemen say as we were leaving, I can't say on the radio, but they were definitely symbols of how little faith the military police, at least back then, had in the abilities of the Iraqi police.
And how did that match up to the stories that you read about what was going on in Baghdad when you came back home?
Well, I mean, I certainly think back then they probably matched up a little bit, but I still have friends who are in the military and who are coming home, and I don't hear them being any more confident about the abilities of, you know, the Iraqis, their security forces at this point. And I think, I don't know if I would blame the media or who, but I know that we think we're confident we're leaving next year, and I don't know, I kind of agree with your guest that it's going to be difficult to do so.
Is Chris telling it like it is, or are administration officials engaged in wishful thinking?
I think they are. I think that Obama and the people around him are repeating the optimism of the Bush administration. It's not a departure from Bush to say you want to get out of Iraq. George Bush didn't invade Iraq saying, I have a great idea. Let's go get stuck in a quagmire for 10 years. The original war plan had us down to 30,000 troops by September 2003. Well, here we are 7 years later. We have more than four times that number of troops. And the new president is saying, I want to get us out of Iraq, out of fighting in Iraq by August of next year. Well, just because you hang up a mission accomplished banner doesn't mean the war ends. Just because you say it's a non-combat mission doesn't mean the war ends. The war ends when American troops stop dying. And I was over actually at the White House the day of the president's speech, and I said, does this mean American troops will stop dying in August 2010? And a military official there said, no, it does not mean that.
Chris, are you scheduled to go back?
No, actually, I was supposed to be there right now. I was involuntarily recalled last spring, but depending on your perspective, I guess you could say luckily I got injured in training and I didn't have to go.
We hope the injury is not too serious, Chris. Thank you.
Oh, no, I'm fine.
Oh, good.
Thank you.
All right, appreciate it. Joining us now from our bureau in Baghdad is Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR's foreign correspondent. She joins us from the bureau there in Baghdad. Good to have you back on the program as well.
Hi.
And where do you go for your information? Obviously, like Tom Rick, sometimes you go to the U.S. military. I assume you have other sources as well.
I'd just like to speak to something that Tom Rooks just said. It's kind of interesting. The war ends when no U.S. soldiers are killed here. You know, it's through all this, you tend to forget the Iraqi narrative. We're talking about the Obama administration, what they think, what they believe. Of course, there is a sovereign now Iraqi government who also has a say in what happens here and what kinds of, U.S. forces remain here and what the war will look like for them. It's not only U.S. soldiers who die, but also, of course, Iraqi civilians, Iraqi army, Iraqi police. And that also that characterizes exactly what will happen here in the coming years and months.
That's a good point. I should have said our war ends when U.S. troops stop dying.
Yeah.
I think their war goes on for decades.
Possibly, and it's certainly a sobering thought for the Iraqis that I speak to here. I do spend, you know, when you're living in Baghdad and covering it, I've been covering this since 2002, actually. We have to deal with the U.S. military and, of course, the Iraqis as well. And we, you know, it's a balancing act. And our staff monitors six papers every day, three Iraqi channels. And, of course, then we go out. Now that the security situation is better, I travel all over the country. Tomorrow I'm going into Anbar province up near Haditha. I've been pretty much everywhere nowadays in Iraq, and that, of course, allows you to do reporting as you would in any other country, which means getting on the ground, talking to people, and seeing exactly what's going on for yourself. Before, we had to rely on the U.S. military. They're the ones that used to take us places. We had to embed. We had to see things through their prism. Now that has changed dramatically, and we can really go out in a way that we've never been able to since, you know, the early days of the war to see for ourselves exactly what's going on.
And let me quickly follow up again on something Tom said. Decades, Tom?
Yeah, I think there will be people fighting and dying in Iraq for decades.
And Lourdes Garcia Navarro, do you agree with that?
Well, I think that may possibly be true. I mean, as I try and point out in many of my reports, you know, I think the for many Americans, they believe that the war is over. I mean, there's a lack of interest now that President Obama has said that they will be withdrawing U.S. forces in great numbers in the coming year, not this year, but next year. I think people have sort of thought, well, the war is over in Iraq, but people die here every single day. There are many simmering conflicts. It might not look like the conflicts that we saw before during the sectarian violence, but there are other things that are going on here that could presage many bad days here to come. I don't know. I'm not a prognosticator, but
sure.
Certainly Iraq is not stable yet.
I think it's a good point that the war has changed several times. It started as a blitzkrieg invasion, then it was a botched occupation, then it was a slow-rising but durable insurgency, then it was an American counteroffensive. The war is changing again. It kind of feels like a lull right now. But just because it's changed doesn't mean it's ended. And a lot of Americans have stopped paying attention because I think they wrongly think that it's over.
Let's get John on the line. John with us from Cincinnati.
Yes, I'm actually in Iraq currently. I'm home on leave. And this is my second tour. I was in Baghdad in 06, and now I'm in southern Iraq. And I can tell you that from my perspective, an infantryman on the ground, the war's pretty much over. And we've received one attack all year, and we've been there for 9 months so far.
And that's much different than your first tour, I assume.
Oh, we would get rocketed every day on my last tour. And this tour, nothing's happened so far.
So from your vantage point, is it possible to pull the troops out safely?
I think so. The IPs and the IAs really don't want us there. We offer them free help. We have civilian contractors, former policemen, who come and offer these IP chiefs help. And the IP chiefs say, no, we don't want your help. And we schedule meetings for them, and they just don't show up. They don't want us there. Most of the guys I know, I'm pretty low on the totem pole. We don't want to be there anymore. We see no purpose. There's no bad guys that we found.
IPs are Iraqi police. IAs are Iraqi army?
Yes.
Okay. And they seem to be perfectly competent and ready to handle any challenge?
Oh, no, they're absolutely incompetent, but they don't want us to help them.
And if they don't want help, then you can't really help them very much.
No, if you offer them this great training, say, hey, we'll train your entire police department, and you go out there and you get five guys, and now you've got a teacher-to-student ratio of about four or five teachers to one student, it's not worth our effort to drive out there and drive back.
So not a lot of point, do you think, to your second rotation?
I'm sorry?
Not a lot of point to your second rotation.
Yeah. The first rotation was very different. I was there for the sectarian violence in Baghdad. We would find bodies all over the place. They'd rocket us every day. But this time around, it's from where I stand in southern Iraq, that part of the war is over.
John, continued good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
We're talking with Tom Ricks of The Washington Post and with NPR's Baghdad Bureau Chief Lourdes Garcia-Navarro. How do we know what we know about what's going on in Iraq? Give us a call if you've been there, 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. Stay with us. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about how we gather information on Iraq through the fog of war with NPR foreign correspondent Lourdes Garcia-Navarro. She's our Baghdad bureau chief, with us on the line from Baghdad. Also with us here in Studio 3A, Tom Ricks, who covered the war for The Washington Post. His latest book is titled The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq. If you've been there, do the statements of policymakers and the news reports you hear and see reflect the story as you know it? Tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation on our website. That's at npr.org/talkofthenation. And Lourdes, how many bureaus are there open full-time in Baghdad these days that are out doing what you're doing every day?
Ah, these are very, very difficult days in Iraq because, of course, it's extremely expensive and has been extremely prohibitively expensive to cover this war. NPR, I think, spends on the order of $1 million a year, which is a lot of money for an organization like us, security costs and everything else. And what we are seeing is a drawing down of the press corps as well. We are seeing many of the very, important news organizations here, the Washington Post, ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, Fox News, the ones that have been here from the very beginning, are now actually reducing the number of correspondents that will be covering this conflict. And I think that that is a measure of the fact that there are important stories out there that deserve a lot of attention, like, of course, the global financial crisis, among others. Afghanistan, of course, is getting a lot of attention as well. And we are seeing diminished interest in what is happening here in Iraq.
Tom Ricks, you were saying earlier, obviously there's still many more American troops in Iraq than there are in Afghanistan, even planned to go to Afghanistan. And you were saying one of the things that the soldiers were telling you, does anybody still know we're here?
Yeah, that came up a lot in my last trip, is people just wondering, do people understand we're still out here? I mean, the numbers have really not come down. Even the numbers, if they come down as they're planning this year, will still be at about 132,000 troops, which is roughly the average we've had there for the entire war.
Let's get another caller on the line, and let's go to Mike. Mike with us from Fort Leavenworth, Kansas.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
How you doing?
I had served in, I was an advisor with the U.S. Marines in Ramadi, Iraq in 2004. And back then, what I had found is, although we always saw the way ahead is developing the Iraqi army, it seemed like back in 2004, we were not the primary mission. The primary mission at the time, as you remember, was conducting the fighting the insurgents in and around Al-Anbar. What I had found also is through blogging and through just asking back home is the military, some of the junior officers, to include myself, felt somewhat frustrated that not only were the higher ranking officers, but it seemed like the media were not asking the hard questions back in early 2004. For both the for all of you, do you feel that the media has learned from those lessons from 9/11 on to start asking those harder questions?
Tom,
well, what sort of hard questions are you thinking of?
Well, it seemed, when we were there, the focus of, was not, people didn't realize that we were, although we were talking about it, I didn't feel like the advisory mission was getting the focus that it should have. From the junior officers that were doing it, we just didn't seem as supportive as we could have been. And although I mentioned it to some of the reporters in my area of operations, the focus back then was, as you remember, Fallujah. And it didn't seem like we were getting the support from the military and also from the media, thinking because we were not, as you might think, the more important mission back then. Is the media realizing that the advisory mission is more important, and also is you're asking those harder questions, questioning our higher command authorities in the area?
Well, a couple of points. First of all, the transition advising the Iraqis was the top priority under General Casey. It was only when the advisory mission, the transition, was dropped as a top priority by Petraeus and Odierno, the U.S. policy in Iraq became effective. They moved it from number one to number six on the mission priority list and said, our number one focus is going to be protecting Iraqi forces. Protecting the Iraqi population. The second thing I would say is it's not my job to support the military. My job is to report, to ask questions. And I think we did ask the hard questions. In fact, my take on the war is rather different, I think, than yours. I think in the first several years of the war, the media was well ahead of the U.S. government and the U.S. military in understanding the situation. I used to hate going into the Green Zone because every time I was there, you just have this feeling that these people were in outer space, that they didn't understand the situation. I think when the surge began, January 07, things began to change. I remember early 07 being in the Green Zone and actually talking to David Kilcullen, who was an advisor to Petraeus, and thinking, my God, this guy understands the situation in Baghdad better than I do. That was a novel experience in the Green Zone.
Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, let me ask you, are today reporters asking commanders in Iraq hard questions?
Yes, I think so. I mean, I think Tom Rooks is right. I think the media was ahead of the curve back then, and I remember myself going into the Green Zone, and obviously it's all very well known now how completely out of touch they were. I think that's changed now, obviously, after the surge, and the realities on the ground are, I think, well understood by many of the military commanders here. We not only have to ask questions from the U.S. military, though, we now have the Iraqi government as well to contend with. And they also need to be asked tough questions. It's difficult to get in touch with some of them. Nouri al-Maliki, the prime minister, does not give many interviews to the foreign press, for example. It's very important to hear his opinion, what he thinks, but he does not give the foreign press very much attention at all. So it's a difficult sort of landscape to navigate.
And that whispering you heard was Tom Rooks, I think, asking for permission to ask a question.
Yeah, Lourdes, this is Tom in Washington, first-time caller with a question. Do you really think the Iraqi government can be considered sovereign at this point?
No. I think that they would even say that they aren't considered sovereign. I think when you have the presence of 140,000 U.S. forces here, I don't think any government would say that it was sovereign. I think the Iraqi people certainly don't think that they are sovereign. You speak to them on the streets, and they will not say that this is a sovereign country. They will say that this is a country under occupation. That said, there is now a legal framework in place, and I do see the Iraqis taking control more and more. As we just heard from that other caller when he said the war is over and that the Iraqi police, won't come and give, you know, participate in the amazing training that the U.S. military is giving them. You know, there's a lot of resentment when I speak to some of the Iraqi police and the Iraqi army about the way that they've been treated by the U.S. military. As you heard, there's not a lot of respect there. Perhaps they don't deserve it. But this is their country. I'm speaking for them, not my own personal opinion, things that they've told me. This is their country, and they believe that at this point they should be able to stand on their own two feet. Whether they're able to or not, of course, is the subject for much debate.
Mike, thanks very much for the phone call. Appreciate it. And we're going to one of those moments where pay no attention to that man behind the curtain. There's one microphone and one headset there at the Baghdad Bureau. We're going to ask Lourdes Garcia Navarro, our Baghdad Bureau Chief, to take it off for the moment and put instead Ghassan Adnan in front of the microphone. Lourdes, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're welcome.
Ghassan Adnan is an Iraqi producer and translator for NPR. He's been there for, of course, many years, and he's with us from our bureau in Baghdad. Ghassan, thank you very much for joining us.
It's my pleasure.
And who do you turn to in terms of your sources of information as you report on the city you grew up in, the country that is your country? Who do you turn to to separate rumor from fact?
It depends. Sorry. It depends on the people themselves. I mean, whenever it depends on the kind of the story you're doing. If you are talking about military story, if you are talking about social story, of course, we have to go to some people who are living that story, who got some information, some knowledge about that story. For instance, if we report about the army side, we have to talk to some locals, of course, from that army side, sorry, whether police or army. So we have to establish a relationship with them, and we have to guarantee that the kind of information they are giving us are real, true, because, you know, everyone got a certain kind of agenda, personal agenda, political agenda, and everyone has, or they think that they have to promote their own agenda. And our job, our part, is that we have to sort out truth from the true information from non-true information. And this is a very hard job. But generally speaking, that we have to talk to everyone. And, of course, every part of the city here differs from the other part. Every single piece of information you get, you have to verify it. And you have to go to different sources. Local sources, friends, relatives, whatever, then you may say that I know something about a certain incident. It's a long, difficult process, but you have to go through it.
And you've worked for NPR for some time. I assume there are people you knew who, before you worked for NPR, who are now in positions to provide you information. Is there anybody that from the old days that you continue to trust? Is there anybody you've met since you've started working for NPR who you now trust?
For sure, because, you know, things are changing here. During the past, of course, we knew many persons and we were trusting them. But, you know, as things change, people also change. Sometimes whenever they get involved in certain political activities, when they get involved in government operations or whatever, they may change their minds, they may change their attitudes, they may change their behaviors. So in the past, we were depending on them. I used to go to certain people and get information from them. They were really trusted. But later on, they joined the government, and they were promoting for their political agenda. And I was having discussions with them. I was telling them, but in the past, you were telling me something else. And right now, you have changed completely. Then they would tell you, well, things get changed, and we have to go on with what is happening right now. So, of course, you have to omit them from your trusted list, and you have to find someone else. But generally, there are some people that you trust, and you have to go to them all the time, and there are some people that you used to trust in them, but not anymore. So it depends on the situation, and the major or the golden rule here is that you have to verify every single piece of information you get, because things are changing and changing dramatically. So there is no way to keep a permanent trusted people or a permanent trusted sources. You have to verify every single moment, whatever you are receiving.
Now let's get Lorraine on the line. Lorraine is calling us from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Hello.
Hi, Lorraine. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Oh, thank you. I wondered, I realized Tom Rick said he doesn't speak much with Arabic-speaking people, but Lourdes Garcia does, and probably Tom does sometimes also. I wondered how they check out their translators, not just for accuracy, but might they be hearing a metaphor, or there's something that's more than one way to take it.
Tom, quickly to you, and then, of course, to Ghassan.
Well, it's something you have to work with a lot. I found early on I was bad at it, and I'd have to sit down at the end of the day with a translator and say, don't summarize, don't tell me part that you think I might be interested in. Try to give me a literal translation. But I want to say more broadly to Ghassan and Adnan and others, these people are my heroes. The Iraqi staffs of Western news bureaus, especially American news bureaus, have been there day in and day out for years under much more duress than American reporters who can leave when they want to or have to. These are people who I think deserve collectively a Pulitzer Prize.
Ghassan, congratulations. As for the translation question that Lorraine has, how difficult is it? Obviously, English is your second language.
For sure, it's very difficult, especially if you don't master the language. Yes, of course, English is my second language, and I don't claim that I speak perfect English, but I manage to communicate with others. And the problem is that whenever you talk to people, especially when you have non-Iraqi reporters with you, you have to translate everything. But the problem is that, and as everyone else is aware of it, there is some kind of cultural differences here. And our culture, the Iraqi culture, the Arabic or the Muslim culture, is much different than the Western culture. So things being said in our culture might mean something different in your culture. So we have to be aware of this, because sometimes for non-Iraqis, even if they know the language, the local language, the Arabic language, when they hear a certain word, they may explain it or put it or interpret it in a different way, different than an Iraqi one. So we have to go through these difficulties and these kind of metaphors, whatever proverbs or saying in our culture, and we have to put it in a way that gives you the real meaning, but in a frame or in the language that you may understand. Because if you keep on translating literally word by word, you will lose the meaning. Mm-hmm. You have to go through metaphors. You have to go through figures of speech to convey the meaning. It's a difficult job, but you have to do it. And you have to master this language. And you have to understand the exact or the hidden meaning, just like you have to read between the lines. Then you may tell the meaning or what is meant by a certain word.
Lorraine, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you for this program. And I must say, I wince in a very special way when I hear that a translator was killed. It's a public service. And thank you for the program.
Thank you, Lorraine. We're talking with Ghassan Adnan, who's a producer and translator for NPR in Baghdad. Also with us, Tom Ricks of The Washington Post. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Sean on the line. Sean with us from Columbia, South Carolina.
Yes, sir.
Go ahead, please.
I get a lot of my news from you guys and also online, but a lot of the stuff going on over there. I was over there in 2003 when we first rolled through, and then I just got back in 2007, and a lot of the stuff over there, I think we began fighting a war that's been going on for thousands of years religion-wise. So as a medic over there, I've seen a kind of both sides of the story, and I think we're going to have a hard time pulling out as quickly as Obama thinks. And a lot of our guys are dying for senseless reasons right now, so it's tough.
I think everybody would agree with that last part. Ghassan Adnan, what do Iraqis you speak to tell you about when the White House announces plans that they will pull out even faster than the timetable laid out in the Status of Forces Agreement?
Well, it depends on the people or the kind of people you're talking to. Some of the Iraqis that we're talking to, they are extremely happy that the Americans are going to leave and Iraq will be an independent country again, and no foreign soldiers will be on the ground, only Iraqi army, Iraqi police, which means that we have full control over the ground here. Others are really pessimistic, and they're saying, no, it's not good, because once the U.S. Army would leave, so sectarian violence, terrorist groups, insurgents, militias will resume their activities, their criminal activities, and they have no trust in the abilities or competence of Iraqi police and army. So it differs. Also, whenever you talk to some politicians, also, it's according to their political agenda. They may tell you something as they think or as they want you to think. They will tell you, no, if the Americans would leave, we're going to lose certain power that we are enjoying right now, mm-hmm. and the favor goes to the Americans. Others will say, no, it's not like this. But when you go to the street level, generally speaking, or the majority, they are saying, well, if Americans would leave, something bad is going to happen, because till now or up to this moment, Iraqi security forces, yes, they are doing a great job, good job, they are being developed, progressing every day, but they are not up to this task or this mission. They have to spend more time, more training by the U.S. Army. Then they get qualified enough to keep security.
And Tom Ricks, very quickly, 30 seconds. You were talking earlier that it's a moral obligation the United States has, you believe, to stay as long as necessary.
Not maybe as long as necessary, but I think we're going to find ourselves recognizing that we're in a very hard choice and that there are no moral answers. This staying might be the more moral of the least immoral answer. I was struck the other day when a city councilman in Ramadi was quoted in the newspaper as saying, "We need the Americans to stay here to protect us from the local police."
Sean, thank you for the call. We appreciate your service.
Thank you, sir. Have a great day.
And Ghassan Adnan, we appreciate your service, too.
It's my pleasure.
Ghassan Adnan, an NPR Iraqi producer and translator with us from our bureau in Baghdad. Our thanks as well to Lourdes Garcia Navarro, our Baghdad bureau chief, who was there with us earlier, and to Tom Ricks, who covers the military for the Washington Post and is now the Washington Post special military correspondent. His most recent book, The Gamble, General David Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq. He was with us here in Studio 3A. Thanks, Tom.
You're welcome.
Coming up, critics panned The Watchmen as a disappointment and inconsistent. What did you think? Stay with us. It's Talk of the Nation.